Hello and welcome once again to episode 136 of Code Completion. We are a group of iOS developers and educators hoping to share what we love most about development, Apple technology, and completing your code. My name is Dimitri and I'll be your host once again for this episode, and I'm joined today by my fellow completionist, Spencer.
Hey there.
I was about to call you my favorite completionist, but then Fernando would be sad. So let's just jump right into it. We have a ton of things from WWDC week that I want to get to. But there's one thing that's a little bit more important, and not specifically for a single app developer, but that's why we of the iOS community are involved, because it is because of a single iOS developer. The iOS developer, Christian Selig, who wrote the Apollo, the excellent Apollo app, which is a Reddit client, is shutting down because Reddit is being stupid. And it is honestly heartwarming to see basically all of Reddit's community telling Reddit to go away, for lack of more flavorful words. And yeah, there's going to be a blackout, basically a boycott on June 12th, which is today, and at least 48 hours for a lot of them, but some indefinitely. There's a lot to go over with this, but yeah, it's quite surprising that this is actually, for once, like the internet kind of doing good things, which is awesome.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I think as opposed to like Twitter, it's perhaps a little bit easier for like these single clusters of subreddits to kind of band together. It just happens that there was a lot of them to do that. So that's super cool. We'll get to it in a second, but there are some like gnarly big subreddits that are going to go dark.
The biggest, super cool. In fact.
The biggest. Oh, all is it, the are biggest. They the biggest?
Yeah, nice. All the biggest ones are going to go along with us, which is amazing.
Yeah. So it's we've got a few things that I'm sure we'll put in the show notes, but it's there's a couple just screenshots of posts on Reddit where, you know, I guess sort of what happened is the people at Reddit are essentially bullying Christian and the other developers. And to Christian specifically, they're sort of saying that he was blackmailing or threatening Reddit, which not really sure about that. He seems like a nice guy. I watched the if you haven't watched it, Snazzy Labs on YouTube did a interview with Christian. It was like at least 30 minutes. It was really good, and he just seems like a nice guy. So I'd be very, I mean, just from that, it's hard to say, but I'd be pretty surprised if he was actually threatening them in any way. They also said he's kind of wishy-washy.
There's full audio of the entire conversation that happened.
Oh yeah, that's
because he's Canadian and it's legal in Canada to record phone calls. Illegal in California, but legal in Canada. That is tough noogies for Reddit because it basically confirms everything that he's been saying. It like you really have to go at it with a very defensive mentality to see it as a threat, because it's certainly a threat in the other direction. To respond to a threat defensively by saying like, oh, it would be almost cheaper for you to buy me, it is not a threat to your big corporation. And to see it as that is so, so small of you. But to then understand that it's not a threat in that same phone call and then proceed to go ahead and tell everyone at your company who you are leading, I'm talking about being the CEO of Reddit, that it was a threat, and that this developer is a scumbag, and then like I'm paraphrasing, but it's much worse. Anything you think it is, it's much worse, which is so unbelievably stupid. It's so stupid that publicly during an AMA that people honestly didn't think would actually happen, he the CEO of Reddit, went to continue berating the developer rather than taking the peaceful, like a lawyer approved way out. No, he just dragged through the dirt through these lies that they built up that don't exist. And it's just sad, honestly. Yeah. And it makes the case that Reddit is maybe not the best stewards of their own community, which is a who'da thunk.
Yeah, right. What's interesting is in the CEO's post, he says that there are like carve outs for mod tools and bots that will have free API access. It really is just like we talked about, I think last week or the week before, obviously the people that are using the API for training large language models. And then it just happens that these Reddit clients are sort of caught in that like non carve out. So everyone else is fine. It just sucks that, you know, the way that a lot of people ingest Reddit is they're just saying, screw you, basically.
Yeah. And guess what? All the people that love Apollo are probably your most diehard fans that really yep. wanted something that was full of quality. And just browsing around, it seems like none of those users want anything to do with Reddit anymore. And I know that community. It's all of us on Mastodon, right? Who are just frankly sick yeah. of Twitter after what Elon Musk pulled there. And this is the same malarkey. So it's just very comforting to see the entire internet round up. Even if Reddit changes its mind, like it's not going to be permanent, right? The future of Apollo is Christian did say, like, hey, if this changes, I'm going to keep Apollo up. So like hoping for the best, but yeah.
He
cannot bank on that at all. So if you do want to support him, he has another wonderful app called Pixel Pals, mm-hmm. where you get little pixelated pets that just hang out in your dynamic island and stuff like that. Yeah. And that is so, so cool. So just let's go back to simpler apps without giant dependencies on giant corporations and wish for the best, I guess.
Yep, definitely. So we'll definitely post this in the show notes, but someone's compiled a list of subreddits that are going dark or read only on June 12th and after. And I mean, r/funny, is that the actual largest subreddit? I didn't know.
I think so. 40 million okay. plus users.
40 plus million users. And then there are 30 plus, 20 plus, 10, you know, and down from there. Combined subscriber count, 2.8 billion. Holy crap. That's yeah. insane.
It's basically every Reddit you've ever like heard of. Like yeah. I was honestly surprised to see Am I the Asshole, which is a very funny yeah. Reddit, not private. And guess what? They basically have a post that goes over how they don't agree with how any of this is right for Reddit to do. And they have a post called Am I the Asshole for Blocking Your Go-To Time Killer from June 12th to 14th.
Nice.
So it's quite surprising to see basically the whole of Reddit tell Reddit to rethink this strongly.
Yeah.
And to listen this time, which they may or may not listen, but this should be very scary for Reddit, because any valuations that you thought you might have yeah. go out the door the moment something like this is public, and it's public. So that's it, honestly.
They already went public. I couldn't remember if they already had or not.
No, going public as in the Red Dark, which is the the site that like accumulates all this information, is basically like outlining all of this. So that it's public information now that your entire community mm-hmm. hates you, and yeah. anyone who is willing to invest in your company is not going to invest in your company if they know that your entire community hates you. So it's tough times for Reddit. You made the wrong move, and
yeah,
you are reaping the consequences.
Yeah, definitely on them.
Some final notes. Paul from Tapbots, which wrote Tweetbot, and Tweetbot being one such app that went through a similar thing, just gave a gentle reminder to have something that he calls an oh crap screen. This is a remotely triggered screen that can allow you to notify your users when an oh crap situation comes up. So if you do have any amount of gigantic dependencies, that is one such. Steve-tron Smith also makes a point that, like, hey, all you app developers making fun new apps on this newfangled thing called OpenAI, consider this a warning sign, because that is likely to happen as well. So, like, figure alternatives out now while, like, all the cards are on everyone's hands before none of the cards are in your hands, and then you end up in a similar one-way street to, like, having your whole service, your whole app, your whole business, and potentially your private life shut down because a company thought that they weren't making enough money the way they wanted to make money.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great reminder for sure.
So on to stuff that actually pertains to iOS development. We have some new Mac reviews. Six Colors went and reviewed both the 15-inch MacBook Air and the brand new Mac Studio. And they had nice things to say about both.
Yeah. I thought it was really cool with the 15-inch MacBook Air. They did some, like, good, I guess, quality of life improvements. I mean, for example, it's a bigger screen. It's also brighter, but they also upped the battery with it to make it have the same battery life as the 13-inch MacBook Air, even though it's consuming more power. So that was like, okay, cool. They've got some good graphs. It looks like, you know, nothing huge. They're slightly better than the 13-inch MacBook Air, probably just because of thermals. But yeah, so seems good. I think it's going to be a terribly good seller for, you know, college students and whatnot. So,
yep. And the price difference between the two models for spec to spec is just $100. So
yeah,
I think it starts $200 higher because it doesn't have the lower, like, what do you call
storage
that?
Storage or something.
When you have, like, chips that you put in different bins, lower bin chip. Bin. There we go.
Yeah.
Just had to walk through the thought and the word would come to me. But it does not have that lower bin chip that the 13-inch MacBook Air has. So that's why there's a $200 difference. But once you spec to spec compare them, it's just $100 for an extra inch and a half or so. Like, it's always loosey-goosey with these inch numbers. Of more screen, which is a lot more pixels, and a lot more space to rest your hands, a lot more battery. All in all, it's quite a great deal. So that's awesome.
Yep. Also, like Dimitri said, Six Colors reviewed the Mac Studio, the M2 Ultra One. I think this one, personally, for me, is a little bit more interesting. They've got some good graph comparisons of, like, Geekbench and everything. And so, like, the single core and multi-core score of Geekbench, not that much better than the M1 Ultra.
Well, single core is over 2,000 for once, right?
Yeah, that's true. Oh, sorry. I was looking at the M2 Max. Yeah, you're right. So the single core for the M2 Ultra, 2025. The M1 Ultra is 1783. So that's a pretty good jump. And then the multi-core score is 25,000 versus just about 24,000. So not huge, but then we jump into the Metal and Xcode benchmarks. And this is where I thought it was really interesting. The M1 Ultra got 92,000 points, but the M2 Ultra got 125,000 points. So that's pretty big margin difference there as well. And then whatever their Xcode benchmark is, I assume. It's from
just GitHub. Seconds. Yeah.
It's just compiling something, I guess.
It's compiling a whole bunch of different types of projects.
Okay.
And yeah, it's significantly better than all the other Macs. So if you need to do development, this is a subtle nod to, hey, turns out lots of cores, we're finally using them. And it's looking quite good. So that's something that you might want to consider. And I think this was quite possibly the only critique of the original Mac Studio, was the fact that, hey, there's so much thermal headroom in this thing. Why is the fan always on? Why is it always loud or audible? Not loud, audible. It seems they fixed that. The fan is still always on, but it is significantly less audible to the point where you can have it on your desk and you don't hear the fan at all. That said, the old Mac Studio, which I have behind me, is not loud or audible to in most circumstances. If you're doing very peculiar like audio work and you don't want your mic to pick up anything, sure, it might come up. Like when I'm listening to this mic, I hear everything in the house and neighborhood. Like the mic picks everything up. whereas your ears, not so much. Like the spinning hard drives that are below me, way, 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 way louder than the Mac Studio. So just to set some expectations there, they made it even quieter. So yeah, if you need a very quiet, very high performing Mac, this is the one to get. And just don't look at the Mac Pro, because I don't think Apple even sent out review units. You see any?
I haven't seen any.
So we might be wrong. There might be some, like as we're recording, this is when all these reviews were coming out. So there might be some Mac Pro like reviews coming. It seems like they didn't really tell anyone or like give anyone one. If you want it, you can buy it. But otherwise, it doesn't seem like they're super proud of it. And there are some new details that might indicate why.
Yeah, this is interesting. So someone was trying to figure out, Hector Martin on Mastodon was trying to figure out, you know, how, he looked at the die shots in the presentations and he couldn't see anything for like an extra PCI controller. He could only see 4x4 lane blocks and 4 Thunderbolt blocks. So he's trying to figure out how, because the Mac Pro has 48 lanes, you know, physical lanes of PCIe. So how is that happening? And he runs through, it's a PCI switch. So he says, yeah, okay, so they're totally cheating, basically.
Yeah, so they gave you lots of expandability. You're not going to get full bandwidth to all of that. That said, not that you need full bandwidth for anything other than, sure, like, maybe the highest GPU. Of high GPUs that did not use full bandwidth anyways. So it's like, is it really that big of a concern? Probably not. Like most cards are not going to use the full like 16 lanes of PCIe 4. And even if they like accept it, they will work with less just fine. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, especially since it doesn't even support GPUs. The only thing I could think of that could like maybe saturate it is like 100, 400 gigabit networking cards, and like that's it. My only question is, with a switch, I wonder if you were somehow to theoretically saturate the bandwidth of everything, would there be like a latency issue with the switches? But that's probably not something that hardly anyone would ever come across. So
yeah, it'd probably be throughput, if anything. Like your network card all of a sudden is not transmitting at 400 gigabits.
Sure.
Now transmitting at less. Maybe. Excuse me. And that's considering you can use all 400 gigabits of your network connection on macOS, is a giant leap.
Good point.
To give a little bit of color, Hector is one of the developers that is working on Asahi Linux. So this is why he's interested in a non-Mac use case. What can we use out of these? And probably will support GPUs at that point, under Linux. It's purely a driver issue. So it's interesting, to say the least. We'll talk about it a little bit, in a bit. But John Gruber, also interviewed a few folks at Apple and did prod about this. The part that I found most interesting is that Apple basically said that we don't really see a benefit in like supporting an architecture that is not using shared memory. No, that's not using shared memory in some capacity. Especially for graphics, like we don't want to just continue encouraging that So we didn't like pursue that at all. Like, it's not that we couldn't, we actively chose not to, because there are such extreme benefits to doing stuff on a GPU that has such a huge amount of memory available to it. And we talked about this a little bit early last year, when Apple started donating its development time to improve Blender, for instance. And it was getting modest improvements, and then it just kept getting better and better and better and better and better all the way up to WWDC. And there were a few talks this year that just said, hey, we were able to get considerable improvement just by changing from this Uber shader to one that's like a little bit more static. Like, it doesn't have these conditions for these various things. And guess what? You can use the Uber shader until the static one is compiled in the background. And then instantly you have dramatically better in performance. So I think there is a lot of GPU headroom that we as developers still did not do not utilize in these new Macs. And it's going to take a lot of effort. And who knows if that effort is going to be spent. To really eke out all of that performance. And that includes developers at Apple. Like, they continue to get more and more improvements out of this architecture. So from their point of view, they see there's lots of headrooms in existing machines that they've shipped. So they don't see them needing to invest in GPUs. Those are kind of their words that I'm paraphrasing as best as I can.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Apple, just from DubDub, it kind of seems like they are, how would you say it? Like, pretty confident in just their GPU silicon. I mean, like, the game porting kit. If they're saying, hey, game developers, this is the time to come, you know, to macOS, that must mean that they think Apple Silicon can keep up with AAA games once, of course, they are optimized and everything for Metal. So, I don't know. I mean, it's pretty interesting to see there. I'm not sure if you've looked at any, but the just what people are doing with, you know, the beta version of Sonoma and just trying to throw in an EXE of some game.
And it works.
It works. I mean, it kind of sucks, but like, it works. So once it's optimized, there could be some pretty good performance there. It could feasibly become what the Steam Deck has done for Linux with its Proton, made it so you can play Windows games on Linux, but you can just do it on macOS now. So that would be interesting. I don't know. I mean, Apple's still in their cat fight with NVIDIA, and I don't think they're ever going to get over whatever their beef was from decades ago or whatever. So I'm really interested to kind of see how it goes. But like I mentioned with the performance graphs from Six Colors, like, the GPU improvement is like 25% or something. It's pretty good. So
that's like almost year over year, which is surprising that we're still seeing those climbs. And we'll probably see them a few more times before it's basically that's it in our lifetimes. So like, enjoy it while it lasts, I guess.
Just cram more cores in there, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, we have to really switch to Swift concurrency and make the most use of that. No more main thread for that to be a thing, unfortunately. There is some speculation that maybe, just maybe, the Vision Pro could launch on January 24th of 2024, because that would be, I think, the 40th anniversary of when the Mac launched.
That'd be cool. That would line up.
A little poetic, right?
It would be poetic for sure. Apple did say early 2024. So if they can hit that, if it really is like early 2024, then that'd be cool. That'd be fun.
Yep. There are plenty, and I mean plenty, of firsthand impressions of the device. Basically, I think anyone who went to WWDC in person, like, had an opportunity to like reserve some time. It certainly felt like it. I don't know for sure because I was not there, but it certainly felt like anyone and everyone had some thoughts to share of the device after they tried it in person. And to be clear, everyone got the same exact experience. I think I linked to them last episode, so I'm not gonna bother linking to any this time. They basically all got the same experience. But the really cool part is that it really is a game changer for pretty much everyone who's tried it. Like, I don't think I've read a single negative in terms of like, oh, it made me motion sick, oh, the thing was glitchy. Yeah. No, it was a super polished experience. That the downs are like, oh, I didn't feel the butterfly, and I was disappointed. Or the dinosaur actually terrified me a little bit. I miss seeing triangles to remind me that it's not real. Those were the kinds of thoughts and feedback that we got. So, I am really, really excited.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Like you said, like no one's mentioned, seeing pixels or like the frame rate being bad and like making you motion sick. It's pretty crazy. Steve Trotton Smith is kind of saying, he says a lot of the WWDC sessions are comparing VisionOS to macOS more so than iPadOS. So there's a suggestion that you can have like a ton of tabs open, or sorry, windows open.
Dozens, they tell us.
There are dozens of us.
the windows.
But he says, I would love to see macOS style resource usage go nuts, open anything and everything you want. So that'd be cool. That'd be really cool. We did speculate like maybe it's like a 3-window limit. So it doesn't seem like that's the case. So that's also a point for, you know, Vision Pro and my somehow plans to afford one.
It's just going to magically happen. There's going to be a budget that magically pops up and it's automatically going to get a little money saved to it. We have quite a ways to go. It's not here yet. If you see yourself wanting one and you need glasses, just like budget $5,000 and maybe you can afford it. I was honestly looking forward to Apple being the one building the prescription lenses, which they are not. Because if Apple was building the prescription lenses, then there was a chance that they would be, frankly, affordable. Because that would just allow more people to try their really cool tech and not spend so much time thinking about piece of plastic. which I think Apple has the engineering prowess to, like, engineer pieces of plastic. But it seems like they probably didn't want to go through the regulatory hell of like being a prescription, blah, 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 especially before their device was announced. So now that their device is announced next year, I'm going to put the flag on the moon here and say that I think next year Apple is probably going to be the ones making the prescription lenses, and they will be dramatically cheaper and they will talk about that. They will show it off with all of their pride that they can do such a better job than the rest of the glasses industry, which frankly, it's there for the taking.
Not hard. Yeah. I will stand on the hill aside from you and say, I don't think they will.
Oh, it's not happening.
No, I don't think so. It'd be really cool. I want to be on your hill. I just don't think it's going to happen.
You don't think the hill exists?
No, you're on a little dirt mound just across the street or something.
Yeah. Another thing that I really do think Apple will probably maybe announce this year rather than next year is the new iPhones probably will have a ability to capture 3D moments. I don't think in hell that Apple believed that that was the only way that people are going to capture these for viewing in the Vision Pro. I think we're an iPhone or two away of like, that's the device that you use to capture. And this is the device that you use to consume that or edit that or work with that. Because like no one is going to just wear the camera on their face, especially at their kid's birthday party or whatnot. So,
That was such a bad example, dude.
But it's all they could show. They wanted to show, like, this is how you capture these things so people don't speculate about future products. But it ended up backfiring on them, I would say. It's like their one miss during all of this.
So let me ask you, don't you, I mean, for like good spatial video and photo, don't you need a semi-wide separation of lenses?
If only these devices weren't ginormous, I say as I hold the phone to my face.
That's my point. So are you saying there's going to be like cameras here and here? Like, how are you going to hold the dang phone without just griming up the lenses?
The same way you hold it now without griming out the lenses. I don't know. Like, I'll leave it to Apple to figure out. I'm sure they can just like use spatial whatever photography to like artificially distance it based on depth data and all that. Like, they will figure it out, but the device is big enough 3DS style to just have two cameras on each end.
I agree. It just
to take bad pictures with, in the 3DS just like the case. 3DS. Yeah.
Yes. All right, we'll see.
Like, they can't be like putting all their cards in.
No, I agree. I think your especially of, after like, software,
everyone blew up about it. They're like, hmm.
Yeah, I think your example of like a software solution is more reasonable than like them putting cameras on both sides of the phone.
Yeah,
yeah.
Also from WWDC, we had a number of podcasts. Ours not included. Not included at all, that were invited to actually record with Apple. Under the Radar had an episode where Marco and David Smith were joined by Josh Schaefer and Chris Thielen to talk about the improvements to Swift UI, to WidgetKit, to like Swift Data. So definitely go check that one out. The talk show had a more... less super techie, but more generally nerdy discussion with a variety of Apple folks, whom I forgot their names of already. John Ternus, Mike Rockwell, and Craig Federighi, along with Greg Joswiak. And they had a lot of fun. Gruber was strong on the case of the Mac Pro. Not satisfying expectations, and it does seem to be that Apple is a little disappointed with themselves for it, just like reading body language and how responses are made. So take with that what you will, because they're not going to publicly say anything to that regard, but the laughters and awkwardnesses are not going to magically disappear either. There was some discussion of like, hey, this new Mac Pro does not have nearly the amount of memory. Are you telling people if they want to go ahead and train these massive models that require this amount of memory, the Mac is not for you? And they're basically saying like, yeah, we're picking our battles at this moment. And this is like where we think we can do well and unlock new possibilities that weren't possible before. And NVIDIA is doing a great job, and let them do what they're doing. That's what they said. That was really interesting. Then they talked about the Vision OS and the new Vision Pro. And then finally they brought Craig Federighi to talk about the software. Good jokes about autocorrect being a hot pile of ducks. It ended with Craig Federighi jamming out on guitar, in case you were wondering if he can actually play guitar. Yeah. And he absolutely can. And they sprung it on him, complete surprise, which was very fun.
Awesome, dude.
One person from Apple was in on it, but Craig was not. So,
cool.
That was very worth watching. And then finally, of the batch that I saw, there was also an episode of Upgrade that was recorded basically right after the keynote, where they shared their thoughts, and was overall very interesting. Go check those out if you're hungry for more content from WWDC now that WWDC is over.
Nice.
In terms of things that did not get announced at WWDC, possibly because they were kind of embarrassed by how bad they were, Stage Manager. Stage Manager is better, it seems. Like, it fixes all the issues that at least Federico Viticci had with it. And if he's an, if he's the person that's giving you the thumbs up to proceed regarding like how the iPad works, then I think you have the thumbs up to proceed. So here's hoping they don't mess it up further in the upcoming betas.
Yeah, definitely. Was the limitation just two windows in the previous release?
No, it was four, but you couldn't have them overlap in any way. And like they had these like very fixed sizes, which were like loosely just the size category, size classes. Mm-hmm. Now you have a lot more wiggle room.
Cool.
You can overlay things. You can make it work for you. So I don't know if it's limited to four windows still. We'll see. It seems like a comparable product can have dozens of windows. So maybe this one can have a little bit more with the same chip and less spatial processing in the process. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess four. I was thinking it was two for some reason. But, I mean, realistically, like, four is probably the limit even for like a 12-inch iPad. Like, there's a screenshot.
They're
on
called
this
windows. They layer. They layer, Spencer. You can have hundreds.
Okay.
They will always fit.
My point is, there's not a lot of space. I don't know. Whatever. For me, it's such a... I mean, I hardly ever even use like the split-screen multitasking in normal iPad OS at all. It's usually just one app. So it's just not something for me. If I want to do multi-window stuff, I'll use my Mac.
Yeah.
So.
Completely fair. I'm just happy that it's better. There was one thing that I completely forgot to bring up, regarding the Vision Pro, going back to it a little bit. We talked about how it has, no pixels that you can really see. And that was more talking about the general resolution of the device. So basically the fact that this is probably the first VR headset where you can actually read text on the headset itself, because up until now they've just been so bad, so poor resolution that you couldn't retest text. But the really cool part about this is they are rendering text not as a bitmap, but as raw vectors on the GPU. So this basically means that it's infinite geometry. I don't know if you remember that. There's like a Euclidean thing from back in the day where they basically showed off, we have infinite geometry. You can zoom in and zoom in and zoom in because we use point clouds. In any case, it wasn't good for games. But this does not use in any way the same technology. But text is rendered on the GPU as vectors. So that way you can just like put your face up to it and you still see crisp curves. But even from far away, there's enough resolution where you can resolve like what's written no matter the size. I did read one review that said like, hey, it's not quite retina. Like you can see a subtle difference between like a true retina screen and this, but it's not far off. It's not nearly as bad as screens used to be pre-retina, which is already way better than most VR headsets. So I think they're in a good place to at least have a device that can render everything around you in as good a quality as you've probably ever seen out of a computing device. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention this is publicly version one, right? I mean, that it's only going to get better from here, so that's good.
Yep. Okay, now on to the more developer-y stuff. And there's a lot of these, but they're all like quite straightforward, so hopefully we can get through them. Swift Evolution updates. Observability is back up there because it shipped and people are finding stuff, and this is your chance. If you think something about observability does not work the way you think it should, now's your chance, basically, to comment up on it because it is not baked in any way yet. If you think something about it should change, you can suggest that. For instance, Swift Concurrency, when it came out at a few WWs ago, it did not back deploy. Observability right. also does not back deploy. Maybe people can change that if they really think it should back deploy. So that's just one example. But yeah, we've linked the forums post, so do check it out.
What I love about this is like, I mean, not that this is the only example, but this is like the system works, man. The system works. I love it. people see things in, you know, the beta Xcode and they're like, oh, it could use this. Great. Let's add it. That's awesome.
Yeah. Swift Package Index, which if you don't know, they basically index all the Swift packages that people write. It's just a GitHub repo you can submit your package to, and then it's part of Swift Package Index. So A plus to that being a thing. They just supported, they just added support for Swift 5.9. And what this means is they will basically have check marks for what platforms and what Swift versions packages run on. And they are going to go ahead and start checking any package that they currently index. Hey, does this work on Swift 5.9? And report any issues. Also, they will go ahead and build the documentation for that. So super A plus for that. I've been using Swift Package Index to generate documentation for Codable Data Source. Awesome that that is part of that.
Very nice.
In terms of new things coming to Xcode, we have macros. And there's just this little tidbit by Helge Hess. I think that's how you say that. Macros are actually implemented as libraries, the ones that are bundled with Xcode. So it's just a dylib that the Swift compiler uses. But when you vend your own macros, it basically just builds a command line tool that just takes via standard input some JSON. And that's basically how it communicates. Send some JSON over, return some JSON with the updated stuff. And that's how the compiler plugin works. So a little cool. bit of under the hood magic for that, which I think is really awesome.
Yeah. Xcode 15 has some sweet new features. This first one, you can see all parameter permutations in the code completion. So you hit the right arrow key and it lists out in the screenshot, they have like dot frame for Swift UI. And that's a perfect example because it has just like a billion permutations. It has so many arguments. So that's so cool. I love that. That's going to be great because you don't have to, you know, scroll down forever and ever just to find the, you know, if something is named similar to other things. So very cool. Super stoked for that.
So good. Logging is also improved in Xcode. So you are most familiar with it in the console. But now you should go ahead and use OSLog to take full control over that. You can go ahead and basically carve out where your logs are from, filter them based on that. You can use them in instruments. It's really, really cool. Kishikawa Katsumi also notes that, hey, if you were relying on like printing out things in tests and you were no longer seeing those results, that's because parallelization has been turned on by default for running tests. So that's why you might not be seeing those results anymore, because once things are parallelized, the log is like good luck following it. It's basically disabled. This basically is a reminder, hey, if you rely on that to be able to debug those tests, you can turn off parallelization and see them again. So that's really, really cool. This dude called Dimitri on Mastodon also notes that Xcode bookmarks are awesome.
Can we trust this guy?
I don't know. I agree with him. That bookmarks in Xcode 15 are indeed awesome. Longtime Xcode users will remember that they used to be part of Xcode, and then they got removed for quite a while. But they are back, and they are back with awesome new features where you can just right-click on any line and say add bookmark, and you just get a little bookmark on the right side. You can click on that bookmark and rename it right then and there in the editor. And then it will show that there. So instead of littering to-dos all over the place, bookmarks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get a little navigator on the left-hand side that shows all your bookmarks. If you delete code around a bookmark, you don't lose the bookmark. It's not like a breakpoint. It just gets like shuffled to a place that doesn't make sense. But what can you do? You still keep the bookmark. Bookmarks can be checked off. So they work like little to-dos.
Very nice.
And they don't go away when you check them off. But when you're done with them, you can just delete them. Super lightweight, mm-hmm. not permanent in any way. An excellent reminder to yourself to finish doing the thing that you needed to do.
Nice. Do you know, I haven't messed around with the Xcode 15 yet. Do you know, do they like get committed or are they just like a local thing?
Just a local thing. They can be committed. I believe they are part of the Xcode user
data D or whatever.
Yeah, user data. That is basically per user. You get a bunch of things like your breakpoints and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think that's where they go. I can't confirm that, but I would assume that if I didn't look into it. So I would assume that a tool can also just read the special file that's there. And anytime there's changes, they can go ahead and ingest those as tickets if such a tool wanted to make use of that.
That'd be cool.
Which none of them exist as native Mac apps anyway. So, that is something that would be really neat to build. If any of our listeners want to make a nice, neat little tool, there's some inspiration. Other new things with Xcode, the developer disk images got an upgrade. Namely, you no longer have one per device version. So you might remember this every time you update your phone to iOS 15.1, 15.1.1, 15.1.2. Plug it into Xcode. Oh, you got to wait for it to prep the device and get all that.
Yeah.
There's only one per OS, and this is going forward. I think there's one per all of iOS, not iOS 17, all of iOS, starting with iOS 17. So this will include iOS 18, 19, 20, etc. So hopefully that just makes things a whole lot more pleasant. And Riley Testa, who makes Delta and AltStore, is the one who found this out. So I hope this just makes it easier for them to do the shenanigans that they were doing, because it's just less to deal with this time around. So that's really cool.
Sounds like so Guy says, looks like Xcode 15 automatically enables Wi-Fi debugging when you pair an iPhone, which is something you had to check before. And then someone else, I don't know if it's them or someone. Oh, it looks like it's from the dubdub Slack. It says that the stack for running wireless debugging is a lot better, which is good, because I have, whenever I need to use my phone or an iPad for debugging, I just always plug it in. It's just always been a crapshoot for me for wireless debugging. So maybe it's better in Xcode 15. That'd be great. I'd really enjoy that.
Yeah. It seems like it's dramatically better. That's maybe it's just doing peer-to-peer now and it's just skipping all of Wi-Fi infrastructure and just making things just more consistent in that way. Maybe it's making better use of the wire and like transmitting less through it. Unless it's really necessary to like focus on just the debugging part, because I remember like setting a breakpoint. Now you're waiting for those variables to come over. It's like, why does that take so long? So that is a very welcome addition, to Xcode. And I hope a lot of people, can benefit from it.
Yep. It seems that in a small way, hell has frozen over a little bit, because, it seems like there's actually documentation and articles regarding new APIs like WidgetKit. So that's an interesting change as compared to previous WWDCs, which is very welcome, though.
I attribute it to our documentation-driven development mantra. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, it's all us.
It's all us. No, I really do think it's Doxy that is like making this change, because it's a lot more pleasant for the developers writing the source to contribute the documentation directly, rather than just assuming it's going to be someone else that's going to do it. And then that doesn't happen, which I have is pure speculation. Maybe that's what was happening and therefore no documentation got written. But now, if just writing code and you're kind of encouraged, you just command option slash, you get everything filled out. You can go ahead and type in that. And now in Xcode 15, you actually see like your documentation being built, as a rendered file. That's a whole lot more enticing to actually go ahead and build out documentation than otherwise, because otherwise you're just going to write whatever and not really pay too much attention. Now you really can like write your method signature and then just write the documentation before the implementation and like clarify your thoughts. You actually have something there that's tangible. So that's what I personally do. I kind of design the API in my head and then write out just the API without the method implementations, and then start with the documentation, because that oftentimes clarifies what I'm trying to do, and just like crystallizes it in a way that you can act on it.
Nice.
Do you remember Parian?
No. Okay. I was going to ask you. I've never used it before.
Okay. So if you were a Mac user in the Mac OS 10 days up until now, and you enjoyed anime, you were very sad because anime, or at least the anime that fell off the backs of trucks with very carefully choreographed subtitles for all the openings and endings. It's amazing what falling off of a truck can do. those were all in either AVI format or MKV format. And that was never something that QuickTime knew what to do with, frankly. There was a very, very cool little system plugin called Parian, which would add encoders and decoders to QuickTime. And I think there was something else before it. My memory is very loose here. But Parian was ultimately the one who took over. And they shut down in 10.4 or something. Like it's been quite a while since we've had Parian. Probably closer to like 10.8, 10.9 is when they stopped. And that was because AV Foundation finally took off. There was no longer a QuickTime subsystem. Carbon was also phased out. There was no path for something like Parian. Well, the times are changing, because there's now a media extensions type for macOS only, so no iOS, unfortunately. But basically, if you have an app, you can go ahead and bundle video encoders and decoders, and the first time your app launches, those will get vended to the system so that other apps can make use of your encoders and decoders.
Cool.
And go ahead and play back videos in AV players and stuff like that. So this is very, very welcome. And I hope that we see something like Parian once again, instead of needing to use all sorts of wacky, playback players. I haven't really used, most of those, for quite a while. Anytime I have to do anything wacky, I just open VLC. This enables it to just happen in QuickTime or in any app that you use. So that's very, very cool.
Nice. Yeah. So my follow up was going to be, have you used VLC? Like, did VLC exist back then for macOS?
VLC was very bad back then for macOS. It certainly got much better. And then there were quite a few players that were based on Matroska that got better. And we're in a much better place now. So maybe something like Parian just wouldn't happen. But it's definitely something that could happen now. So that's very, very cool, especially considering that it's just baked into the system everywhere. So,
yeah,
like that's that quick look would work, like sending an email would work,
that's very cool.
Using Ivory would work, like literally everything that is on your Mac could use these. Final Cut would work, iMovie would work, LumaFusion would work. Yeah. So
right,
that's
cool.
Very, very welcome that something like this is available.
Yeah, I know that like on DaVinci Resolve for iPad, I don't know what the codec is, but it's a codec that isn't natively supported. They just must have wrote it themselves. So I guess they can now use this, assuming I don't know, maybe this gets put onto iOS or whatever, and then anyone could use it.
So yeah.
That's super cool.
I can only guess that this is like the first iteration, so that's why it's macOS only. Apple has for a long time had custom encoders and decoders that if you had a Final Cut Pro, you could download them. And it was like the Pro Video Toolkit or something. And that would enable other apps to use those encoders and decoders. So the system has been there for quite a while. I think this is just Apple finally rounding out the pieces of it. And that's perhaps a theme this year. It very much seems like anything that Apple did put together, they just went ahead and made an API for it. If there was missing functionality, they just opened it up. I remember there's a Swift UI animation talk, and they basically said, hey, the keyframing, you can have full control over the keyframing. You can use it for things other than Swift UI. Namely, I use it to make these Swift charts that show the timing graphs. And I don't know, Apple from a few years ago would never leak the internal like parts that like got you to the end bit. You just got the end bit. And if it didn't satisfy you, oh, well, here's all the pieces in between. It's like, wow, I was definitely not expecting any of this year. So very, very welcome.
Cool. That's awesome.
Other things that like definitely feel like they weren't expected this year. Well, anything that was once relying on Carbon, now there's just like one thing left, the event like handling system. That's the only piece of macOS that has like a little bit of Carbon code still running in it. And that's because the menus, the menuing system that we know and love, no longer use like their Carbon internals. They've been completely rewritten using Cocoa. And that enables them to finally have sane APIs for adding, I don't know, section headers or views. Like it was just wackadoodle up until now to deal with NS Menu. So now it's just much, much better in Sonoma. So A plus to that.
Nice. Always welcome.
Yeah, split views I think got some like niceties.
Oh, nice.
Like if a split is collapsed and you hover your mouse over it, it will just peek a little tiny bit. So that way you know that there's a split that you can grab and that your mouse is in the right spot to grab it. Like just like those little thoughtfulnesses that I once feared were gone from Apple's design language are starting to like make their way back in. So the world is healing now that the Carbon catastrophe is over.
The world is healing.
I don't know how else to put that, but yeah, macOS menus A+.
Another cool thing about macOS Sonoma and iOS 17 is you can share passkeys and passwords not inside of your family, so to whoever you want, which is super cool. And then I loved someone's comment to this. They said, nice. And then in parentheses, Netflix must be hating y'all right now. Lol. Which, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's like 1 year too late for the Netflix sharing use case.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's super, super welcome that iCloud passwords not only can be shared with your iCloud family, which is, I think, what everyone just assumed would be like, when it gets sharing, that's just going to be it. No, just arbitrary groups. You make them.
Whoever
you add to it can access and edit and do cool things. So super, super cool to see that come to Apple's platforms. Security code autofill also works with emails. Finally. So that's like a finally, because I don't know about you, but I've been dealing with a company called Payflex lately. And Payflex, I don't want to give them my phone, so they send me an email. They don't allow copy paste from the email. I have to remember that stuff as I flicker between windows. So that is something that I am very happy to see coming, and I am super tempted to upgrade to OS versions that I should not upgrade to just to get those niceties. But there are some other minor improvements. It will automatically share text with your Mac now if you have iCloud. Like, it's no longer a separate checkbox to like figure out. So that will just make it so much easier to get like codes to transfer. It will delete codes and put them in a 30-day recycling bin. So that way you don't keep those texts around, because definitely those are the ones that are using up space and messages. Definitely not sending like huge videos back and forth. But it's just nice to keep everything cleaner. And yeah, overall, iCloud passwords, two thumbs up. I hope they fix the issue where if you just visit a website, it says, do you want to update your password? And you're like, what? And if you're stupid enough to say yes, then you lose your password. That's like a big thumbs down for me. I think that that like crept in over the past year or two. And I very nearly lost my GitHub password like once or twice. I had to race to another computer that hopefully did not get the edit
turn
yet.
It off.
I turned off Wi-Fi immediately so I can salvage the password before it got wiped and it synced everywhere. Ooh. So there is that. So I'm now very careful with passwords. And there's also like you subscribe to, you make an account and it does not save the password. So I've also gone to the habit of copying any password it suggests just in case it decided not to save it. So there's some iffy things in the current like OS version that I'm not super trustworthy, but in general, over the past like 10 plus years, iCloud passwords have been very nice to have, and I've used them heavily. So I hope this is a return to more sane habits.
Yeah, definitely. CloudKit got some good changes for with macOS and I assume iOS. Yeah. So what would happen before is if you turn off iCloud Drive, it would turn off iCloud CloudKit's like syncing or just any availability of CloudKit
for all every apps. App. Yeah.
Yeah, that's bad. So now you can disable the iCloud Drive, but it will you can sort of disable apps individually now. So that's a great change. Also, I don't know who this is, Tim Mahoney. I guess they have a something called, oh no, CK Sync Engine is Apple's thing. They released, sorry, I'm butchering this. He released a, I guess, a sync API, which brought, oh my gosh, okay, sorry.
Start over.
Can you do it? Sorry, yeah. I don't really, all right.
And then Tim Mahoney is sharing that Apple is now releasing a new thing to CloudKit, and that is a sync engine that takes care of all the syncing, so that way you don't need to about syncing, which is 100% what CloudKit needed, because it is a little bit complicated. It gives you all the bare bones things, so that way you can manage the sync yourself. But then as soon as you need to like figure out what records to keep or records to update, what's changed, making the subscriptions, the push notifications for the subscription, it's a lot. So this just makes it easier. Or at least it claims to make it easier. It will turn what used to be 5,000 lines of code to 500, which 500 lines of code, it might seem like a lot, but that's just a file that you can write in an afternoon. So that's a great addition. And it seems like they were using it in freeform, and that's probably where they were beta testing it. Cool. So if you want to have syncing like freeform does, this is what's going to make it possible. So A+.
I have to say, I haven't used CloudKit in quite a few years now. I used to really, really enjoy it. I'm really happy that Apple isn't like abandoning it, and it seems like they're using it internally for a lot of things, including like notes and like you said, freeform and stuff.
I mean, so Photos is like all built on CloudKit. So
yeah, that's cool. It seems like, I don't know if there's really been much of an improvement to it aside from like that, that core data, integration. So yeah, good overall. That's cool.
Yeah. And if you are curious, CloudKit is actually based on an open source database that Apple actually owns, they back CloudKit on it, and it's called FoundationDB, and FoundationDB is a behemoth of C++ code, but it is really, really cool. It's basically a distributed database that guarantees transactional consistency. So if you have 200 servers that are running your database around the world, you can unplug a whole bunch of them and nothing will be lost. Everything will just continue going. You plug them back in, they will like sync back up and get there. And it is very simple to work with. It's basically a giant dictionary, keys and values.
Yeah, it's That's very it. Easy.
So FoundationDB is super straightforward to think about and build on top of and build complex things on top of. Like, say, I want to implement MongoDB on top of FoundationDB. Go for it. It's considered a layer. It's at your client level. It's not at the server level. And you just have that translate fancy MongoDB documents into keys and values. Straightforward. Your index, just other keys and values. Super straightforward. Inspiration for Codable Data Store? Maybe. We'll see. at least on my storage medium, I'm really kind of using that paradigm quite a bit. FoundationDB is super, super cool. And it actually got a shout out this year's WWDC in a very unexpected place. The part of the improvements of Swift where they said, hey, and you can use C++. And watch us take this really complicated method from FoundationDB and simplify it with Swift. And it really does simplify it. And it makes it really straightforward to read. It uses Swift concurrency. So because of the C++ interop, FoundationDB is getting Swift code, which means that it's something that is likely to become more like better, faster, easier to maintain. And super big thumbs up for me in regard to that.
Nice.
Other improvements that are kind of sneaking in. Do you remember those indirect events that you might have needed to support on iPad? Namely, like from a mouse. And you needed to say, hey, your app kind of does support these or doesn't support these. With iOS 17... everything implicitly supports them. And the key that was in your info.plist is now kind of useless. May or may not be related to VisionOS and being able to just like have apps just work on there. So we'll see if that's actually the case or not in the next few years. But just a heads up that if you were previously saying indirect events, not something my app wants, that is now going to be ignored and you need to actually fix it. PSA there. Other PSA, if you were doing iOS keyboard shenanigans, you can no longer do that because the keyboard is now rendered out of process. I don't know why it was still rendered in process all these years, but you could always see it if you ever pulled up the view debugger. The keyboard was always hiding in some other window, and you can actually see how it works, which was a benefit. That we are now losing, like you can no longer kind of tinker there. Turns out all the keys, one image. You'd think that it would be a whole bunch of others, but it was very straightforward. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Swift UI is getting a crazy new feature, and that is the ability to just have a random shader on your view. This is like... in the wackadoodle segment of improvements that we get this year. I think core image is probably a little sad because macOS core animation at the very least had the ability to add core image filters to any core animation layer. And that was really, really cool until things started being rendered more and more out of process, which iOS always was out of process. Therefore you had no filters. Now it seems like because shaders are inherently not your process, they're just like a little bit of code run on the GPU. You can't really read or write to them while they're running anyways. This becomes something that the system can just run on your behalf. You compile it, you give it to the system. The system will say, okay, here's some funky effects on your view. And that is really, really cool. It kind of enables everyone to play around with shaders. And if you don't know what a shader is, it's basically a program that takes color or some other input, usually position, color, random seed. Like you determine it. It's a function. And it will run it for every pixel. So if you want to move everything in a warpy way, you can just move the color or read from a different part of the image and render it in whatever way you want. So people have been coming up with some cool effects for this. And it's frankly very cool to see, so easy to use. Like, you don't need to set up a metal context. Yeah. You don't need to set up a core image context. Like, even core image had a lot of boilerplate-y like setup that you needed to do. This is just like slap a filter on it, which is just what we wanted all this time, I think.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what people come up with.
Yeah. So, yeah, overall, lots of new things at WWDC this year. I'm still like pouring through the sessions. It's always quite a lot, but definitely loving the improvements that we're seeing. And it's getting very tempting not to just install this on many of my devices. So, will hold out at least till beta 3.
Yeah, we'll see. You have some spares. I mean, it's not like you have a single device. I don't know. I'd do it on one just to see, just for fun.
Yeah, but they're all signed into iCloud, and I made a mistake in the past.
I remember that. Yes.
I put betas on things, and then iCloud Drive was being worked on, and there go files. Poof, poof here, poof there. Ooh. You don't even know which ones are missing. That was not a good time in betas, but those are betas. I have no one to blame but myself. So if you really want to run betas, don't sign into your main Apple ID. Have a backup Apple ID that's just for the betas, which makes the betas a whole lot less useful because you're not going to really use them. However, on macOS, we now have a superpower, and that is running them in virtualization. So if you want to run Sonoma on macOS, you totally can using any one of build your own virtualization framework. It's right there. The only thing that you need to do is you need to download the latest Xcode, and downloading the latest Xcode will like do something that enables this on the OS level. Just a heads up there that download Xcode 15, run it, and then you can go ahead and download your favorite virtualization sample code install Sonoma and see what it's like.
That's cool.
Bonus, you can't sign into iCloud on virtualized OS anyways. So this week's episode of Code Completion is brought to you by Hungry. Hungry, that's Hungry with 3 U's, is the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch app you turn to when you really want to eat, but are blinded by the multitude of choices available to you and your insatiable hunger. Hungry isn't there to help you discover new restaurants or flavors. No, it has a much more humble process. You tell it about your favorite restaurants, and it will deploy its cryptographically advanced random number generator, invoked by shaking your phone in frustration, to make the decisions of what to eat for you. Stuck at home and sick of ordering pizza? Use Hungry. Did Hungry just suggest pizza again? Don't fret, as options for another cuisine, a cheaper option, something closer, or simply another place are just a button away. Hungry also comes with a collection of fun animated iMessage stickers, so you can share your hunger with others. Thanks again to Hungry for sponsoring our show. Search for Hungry, that's HUUUNGRY, on the App Store today to give it a try. So Spencer, I've got a code completion tip for you. And I think in the past we've talked about disfavored overload before, but this being WWDC is a great opportunity to talk about it again. So disfavored overload is a compiler attribute, I don't know what you call these really, that you can go ahead and attach to a method. Basically, if you have two methods with very similar functions like signatures, just different types, for instance, and you really want the compiler to default to the other type rather than this one, but by default, Swift will use one or the other. You can use disfavored overload to basically tell Swift, hey, don't use this function unless you really need to use this function. And it turns out there's a great use case for this. And this is what Tomas Durad is going and outlining in a blog post. So basically, you can go ahead and shadow a new method that Apple just released as a part of the new OS, right? You don't have the want or the capability to like litter if add availables everywhere or pound availables.
Sure.
Right. So you can go ahead and declare the same method, same signature, same spelling, exactly the same. And all you need to do is mark your version with at disfavored overload. And then inside of the implementation, you can have your if pound available. And it will either call the one that is available, or it will just return self or some defaults that will work. And the benefit here is that in your regular code, you don't need to think about it. You just use
sure.
The now available on older OS's counterpart that you ships as a part of your code base. It won't like infinitely recurse as a result of that. It will just simply dissolve out of nothingness on the newer OS's, and it will fall back to any fallback you specify in the else statement on older OS's. And then the best part, when it comes time to delete this because you no longer care about iOS 15, you can just delete the extension. You don't need to modify the code that calls it. So overall, it just makes everything a whole lot simpler and a lot nicer to deal with. So super big A pluses for this from me.
Nice. Could you just name the function, your function, something different so it doesn't recurse, or does it not work?
You totally
way?
Can, but then you need to go ahead and update your code that calls the differently named function, right?
Yeah. Okay.
So
okay.
This is just like a syntactic way to really make everything super clean.
Gotcha. And not have to rename it everywhere. Yeah. That makes sense.
This is something that actually works well with a different tip that I'm going to share today. And this is using the pound if compiler directive. So basically, if you say pound if space compiler open parentheses greater than or equal to 5.9, then the code that's in that block is only going to be considered on a version of Xcode that supports Swift 5.9. So this allows you to start using code that needs the new SDK, but it will still work on older versions of Xcode that don't support the new SDK. So namely, you want to use the new Xcode, but your coworkers don't, or your CI can't. This is how you do that. You just wrap your new code in the if compiler. And then if you are on a new version of Xcode, that will run. If you are not on a new version of Xcode, that will be ignored completely. So it's not even going to be part of the app. So do keep that in mind if you have anything in there not compiled. So won't end up on the App Store at all. But once you switch to the new Xcode, like that will all be available. So you can start developing things early, start playing around with the betas, and still keep shipping your app, which is really a nice thing to have when this busy season is upon us. As always, I want to personally thank everyone for listening in this week. Please be sure to follow us on mastodon.social at codecompletion to know new episodes go live, and feel free to tweet at us if there's ever a topic you'd like for us to dig into. Most importantly, as a small podcast, please be sure to share this with your friends and family who are also interested in any part of the process of app development. It's your support that enables us to continue doing this, and we hope to grow a healthy community around everything we discuss. Once again, I want to give my thanks to Spencer, who is at Spencer C. Curtis. That's S-P-E-N-C-E-R-C-C-U-R-T-I-S for joining me this week. My name, once again, is Dimitri. You can find me at Dimitri Buñol. That's D-I-M-I-T-R-I-B-O-U-N-I-O-L. And we'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Okay. I have a minor gripe to share for commented out.
okay.
And that is me losing lots of time last night. So I very patiently crafted out a system that was working perfectly on my Mac that used key paths to just allow you to index into collections. It was kind of complicated, but seems to be working fine. And I was using those key paths to like automatically figure out, oh, the index is named this, so I'm going to like save that on the database to figure out if things change, like I can re-index and all that. Well, this all kind of fell apart when I submitted my PR to GitHub, because I'm writing PRs to myself just so I can review things and catch things like this, because the little GitHub runner that ran my code on Linux said, what are you trying to do here? Because none of these tests work. And that is why I learned to hate key paths, because they are a half implemented piece of ducks that I am not happy with at the moment, because I learned to trust them. I learned to bring them into my family. And then they shoot me in the foot last moment, in the unsafe code that they are, because I was relying on printing them out and then parsing strings. Mm-hmm. And it turns out those strings are different on Linux than on macOS. But it's not just that. Like, if that's that, and then okay, on Linux, just can't use this on Linux. No. Turns out anything that's computed will have the same thing. And on Linux, it's more robust about this than on Mac. I don't know. I don't know why it's there's different functionality on one or the other. Don't rely on key paths having a name that can be a completely garbled name, because the function is created at compile time and does not have a name. That's totally what the key path could refer to. So that's why they don't have a property for this. So this is my warning to my fellow app developers. Do not rely on Swift key paths for string names. They just don't exist. they will only bring sadness. I think
I was going to say, do you have a solution then?
Yeah, so my bad solution now is the property wrappers that I have. You need to specify what the property name is along with them. The bad part of that is it doesn't really work if you stop and think about it, because if you freeze dry something using Codable, then that key name needs to come from Codable. But if you don't have one from Codable, then you're not going to have one from the code that it's marked up with. So it's very, very bizarre in that way. So that's like problem number one-ish. Problem number two that I am going to need to deal with is, okay, then maybe macros can help me out, but then what is a macro really doing? It can read the name, but it's not going to be able to read down like the graph of key paths that you can build. I don't know. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do about this. If I end up going the macro route, I might like have this just create an enum for me and then just have that be the way that you interface with the indexes, is via these enums that get auto-generated based on the property names that you just happen to index. And that might be the solution, right? But then I need to have a proper macroing system. And I've been like not wanting to do that because I wanted this to work before meeting Xcode 15. So for now, I'm going forward with my very bad idea that's not going to work with Codable, despite Codable being the name of my thing. And I'm gonna hope for the best. I'm going to use that basically in the interim until something better, basically Xcode 15, makes itself available and I can kind of rethink that. But it doesn't really change too much. I don't think Codable will like impact it too much. It probably will. Oh gosh. I don't know. I don't like key paths. They're making me sad. They're making me not want to work on the thing that I want to work on. So that's unfortunate, but yeah.
To be determined, I suppose.
To be determined. Darn you, key paths. I don't know what I'm going to do. Because the Codable thing is really tricky because, I don't know. I'm not going to talk about this here. Don't use key paths to invent new things that you think might be possible with key paths. If key paths don't explicitly say they're possible, then don't bother. It's a recipe for disaster.
Lesson learned.
No, lesson not learned yet, because I'm still like... I don't have an alternative yet, so I'm still going to rely on them for the short term, because I want to get to the meat of my thing, but yeah.
Fair. Could you... In the meantime, could you just like set up a Mac Mini to run your tests or something?
Well, no. So I fixed the tests, but it's like an architectural problem with my design. Because if it's showing up on Linux and it also shows up on some macOS properties, then it's just like, what's the point? Oh, I can't rely on this.
Okay. More widespread than I thought. I thought it was just in your tests that it was.
Not. No. It was my tests pointing out to me that all my assumptions were wrong. And the worst part about this is I wrote all the tests and they all worked. So I was like feeling really confident about it. And I like see, my build failed. And then after my build failed, of course, my internet stops working. And this is, guess I'll tell this right now. So my internet stops working because, this is, I think what happened earlier in the day. I was out shopping, doing groceries, waiting for the deli, folks to get something available, namely delicious bread. And it was going to take like 10 minutes. So I was just there waiting. And I went and filled out a survey for AT&T installation and how happy I was. And I mentioned in that survey, that I did not care for their Wi-Fi because they asked. And as a result, I am greeted at 11:42 p.m. or something that my internet stops working because I guess someone read the survey and I guess someone decided to refresh all the configuration on my modem that I disabled a bunch of stuff. And it's not so much the Wi-Fi part that messed things up. It's the fact that they reset the settings because I have static IPs and the default settings do not support static IPs very well. Therefore anything connected just won't work. So, that contributed to a nice outage in the middle of the night that I needed to deal with, right after GitHub told me that my thing wouldn't compile and I couldn't even read the thing. To AT&T, my 5-star review very rapidly went to a 3-star review after that happened. Because that is not okay. I don't know if, I'm purely speculating. I don't have any proof that you went into my modem and reset it the day that I talked about not using your Wi-Fi or whatnot. But the fact that that happened is very suspicious. And it makes me incredibly mad because sleep deprivation was another thing that was already happening at that time. So needless to say, I have a backup now because my UniFi Dream Machine has 2 WAN ports. The other WAN port is going into another thing in the modem as a backup in case they pull stupid stuff again. Because there is a way for me to like configure the modem. I just need to use a different computer plugged into a different one of its ports. And it's like, why? Why do I need to go through this malarkey in this situation? And it makes no sense. I now have a network system with redundancy, I guess, via another port on my router to another port on my dumb modem. I can now access it when they pull stupid stuff. So that's good for me, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's pretty lame of them, though.
Yeah. Lots of thumbs downs in one evening, which was not fun.
No doubt.
Anyways, thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.